Hello and welcome to This Week in Oklahoma Politics. I'm your host, KOSU's Michael Cross, along with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Well, the governor is getting a bill to require school officials and parents to get involved in the decision of third grade retention. House Bill 2625 passed on Monday by a vote of 83-6, just a few days after Oklahomans learned about 16% of third graders statewide could be held back. Neva, is Governor Fallon going to sign this bill?
Well, I think there's pressure. I mean, there's certainly pressure going both ways on it. And in a political year, I would be hard-pressed to speculate at this point. It's been one of those very divisive issues that's really gotten more and more clouded and more confusing as the debate has kind of drug on. And I think it will be fascinating to see what the governor does. I mean, there's some real derision among the among the lawmakers on this issue, and frankly, a lot of it I think is with a backdrop that is more political with the superintendent's race and some of the other things that are clouding it, as opposed to just the issue itself.
Brian, what are your thoughts? Do you think the governor's going to sign this?
Well, she needs to. We've got 8,000 third graders that did not score satisfactorily on the reading test, and they will be mandated, you know, not any discretionary review, mandated to be held back for a grade for the grade level. And I think that if we look at what those 8,000 students tell us about the folks that had difficulty on this test, it really demonstrates the disparity between urban and rural schools. It represents a disparity between schools that come from affluent neighborhoods and those that are struggling with poverty, not where kids are on free and reduced lunch programs, but where kids are actually going to school hungry. And I think that this bill, which passed overwhelmingly in the legislature with bipartisan support, gives school districts the tools that they need to make individual assessments on these students with a committee of administrators, educators, and parents as to whether or not the kids need to be held back. Some of them may very well need to be held back, but the mandatory sudden death game seven scenario that we've got right now is one that is not going to work, and I think will cause much more harm than good.
And what they do and how they do it is one question. I think the bigger question when you start talking about kids is, if you've got kids that are reaching the third and fourth grade and they cannot read, I mean, we're talking proficiency of being able to read basically cat in the hat level books. I mean, you have no opportunity to have success in school, have success in life, if you can't learn to read. So they've got to address this problem. Whatever, whether you test at the beginning of the year, the end of the year, whatever the circumstance, you can't let a child get to the third grade or fourth grade and not be able to read, or we are dooming them to a life of failure.
Well, it does seem like a double-edged sword. And even if she does sign this, though, is she saying that what she passed, the third grade retention she passed a few years back, was wrong?
I don't know whether she's what it really says. I think what we're talking about is, I mean, the whole concept of social promotion, the whole concept of, you know, just pushing people along in the education system, that these kids, if we are not figuring out a way to identify that they do have reading issues, they do have reading deficiencies, and address that, it doesn't matter. I mean, the adults can argue and bicker and come up with all kinds of ideas, but if they haven't accomplished the basic goal, and that is provide a classroom setting where children can learn to read in grade school, we've missed the boat.
On the other hand, Ryan, are we saying that a child, certainly it's important that a child be able to read,
right,
but are we saying that one test at one point is going to determine whether or not this child can succeed?
You know, I think that we shouldn't confuse a goal of literacy with high-stakes testing. High-stakes testing does not, you know, create literacy. It's certainly a measure of where these students are, but what it leaves out is, you know, we're looking at one test, not the totality of a student's performance over the school year. For the most part, we're looking at students that the number of students that failed this exam, are coming from schools where they have high transient rates. They've got parents that are working multiple jobs. There's high level of poverty. And the disparities that we're seeing in these schools, I think, represent the underlying factors that demonstrate why we're having a problem with literacy rates to begin with. And I encourage folks to go to Oklahoma Education Truth's website. I think it's oklahomaeducationtruths.wordpress.com. The gentleman, the educator that writes that website, has done a great job of outlining, you know, some of the deficiencies in this system.
Employees at the state capitol got a surprise Monday morning when they arrived to find concrete had fallen into their offices in the basement. Ryan, does this raise more flags of concern about the dangers in the nearly 100-year-old building?
Yeah, this would be a metaphor for our state if it weren't so literal. You know you're in trouble when you're living the metaphor. I suppose it's one way to keep, 20,000 plus educators and parents out of the state capitol is to, make the threat that they will get crushed by concrete if they show up to lobby their legislators. This really underscores the fact that we're only one of a handful of states facing shortfalls, all while our economy is doing well. So, I heard David Blatt, I think he was paraphrasing someone else the other day, but David Blatt said, so I'll paraphrase him, he said, it's not a problem with our economy, it's our problem with our government. Our economy is doing well, but we have a tax code riddled with loopholes, including the horizontal drilling tax credit, irresponsible tax cuts, and a shortage of the ability to finance state services that Oklahomans desperately need. And at the same time, the building is falling down around us. So it's like going on vacation while leaving your house in the background with it on fire. It's ridiculous.
Neither the House actually had a bond issue to fix the Capitol. Could have been on to the governor by now. And they decided to not pass that. Do you think that now that's more of a chance to revisit this idea?
Well, it clearly is a question of priorities. And I think the more the public becomes aware, incidents like the concrete falling certainly kind of bring a focus on that, give a real picture of what's going on up there. And I think it hopefully will put some pressure back on the lawmakers to get serious. I mean, this is something that has to be addressed. How they want to bite the political bullet, so to speak, is up to them. But to ignore it and to continue to ignore it is irresponsible. So I think that it will clearly, be one of those issues as they continue through this budget appropriations process, that it's going to continue to come up. And we'll see whether some deal can be put together that would allow for a mechanism to actually start down the road of getting these repairs done.
You hear, legislators all the time and politicians, candidates, they talk about, we need to run government more like a business. Well, if this were a business, they'd be running it into the ground, and the people in charge of it would have been fired a long time ago. But instead, they've made these very short-term, politically motivated decisions with regard to revenue and financing and the services that we're going to take care of and just keeping up with our infrastructure, including the state capitol, not just the state capitol, but including that. And they've operated it like it's a going-out-of-business sale, and it's not. Gone over 100 years now. We'd like to go over 100 more. Let's not budget for the next 2 years. We need to really think generationally here.
Governor, speaking of the appropriations, the governor signed legislation providing $13 million in supplemental to the Department of Corrections. Neva, what are your thoughts on this appropriation?
Well, first of all, there was strong support, I think, in both chambers for this, and clearly a need. I mean, the bottom line with these agencies, certainly Department of Corrections being the one we're talking about right now, they have to be able to pay their bills. And, we have a situation where these supplemental appropriations, unfortunately, the way the whole process has gone in recent years has made it almost an add-on necessary part of the equation, like it or not. And I think one of the things they did do is that they did allow for the director to be able to tap into some of the revolving funds, the interagency monies, to meet some of the obligations that they have between now and the end of the budget year. And that's practical, pragmatic, and then come back to the table and look at where you make the cuts. But vital services that the citizens of Oklahoma expect to be covered, corrections, like it or not, is one of those.
Ryan?
Yeah, well, we're being held hostage by private prisons here. We have bills that we got to pay to private prison companies because they're housing our inmates, and if we don't pay our bills to them, they're going to shift them back to the state. We don't have room for them at the state. We have to put them out to the counties. The counties have become dependent on revenue from the state for incarcerating state inmates in the county jails. We've created this weird circular for-profit incarceration system so that the private prisons are profiting off of it, counties are dependent on the revenue, and Neva's right, we're at a point where almost every year DOC is having to come back to the legislature saying, hey, we need more money than you gave us.
And whether we like it or not, we're a state that incarcerates more people than almost any other state in the United States. With that backdrop, it's a problem not going away, and it's a problem, the items you mentioned, the county jails, the backup of inmates, paying for those, inmate medical services. I mean, every time you start down this road, there are all of these other auxiliary costs that get factored in and drive up the total just to a bigger and bigger bottom line number.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, legislators then need to answer, you know, the fundamental question of why are we locking so many people up? You know, if we don't address, you know, we can address the symptoms all we want. We're doing that with the supplemental appropriations bill. We're addressing symptoms, but we're not addressing the underlying cause here, which is a sentencing scheme that is out of touch with basic public safety and justice needs. And we put ourselves in a situation now where DOC employees are working 60 plus hours. There's a new report out now saying that there's traffic fatalities because DOC employees are falling asleep, going back and forth because they're working these long shifts. We've created an unsustainable system. They're going to keep coming back. The supplementals are just going to get bigger and bigger unless legislators get the guts and the courage to really pass some real criminal justice reforms out of the Capitol.
Well, they did pass the Justice Reinvestment Initiative. Neva, should they now think about revisiting this when we're talking about the supplemental?
I think there's a strong argument. I've said that before. I mean, there's no question they're going to have to find smarter, better ways to address this problem and not just wait till a bill comes to everyone's desk that's a supplemental or even the appropriations bill, give a just a line item amount of money and hope that somehow that meets all the needs.
Right.
And at the end of the fiscal year, they're not having to come back and ask for more to pay the bills.
You know, in the JRI, there's a prong of the JRI that dealt with 85% inmates getting earned credit. And that was part of the JRI. It was stripped out originally. It was back in front of the legislature this year. The new director of the Department of Corrections supported it. I saw a report in the Daily Oklahoma where the governor supported it. It passed through House committee, gets on the House floor. One person says it's soft on crime, and the thing falls apart. And that's where we're at right now, where the tough decisions that are going to have to be made to address these funding shortfalls with DOC just don't have a political shot in the current environment.
A Sooner Tea Party co-creator Al Gearhart got convicted of blackmailing Senator Cliff Brannon, who is running for corporation commissioner, and then turned around and created a parody website dedicated to attacking Brannon as a bigot, I guess because he allegedly hates the Sooner Tea Party. Ryan, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, you go back to the conviction here. I think that the conviction, you know, let's put out the caveat here. You know, Al Gearhart's comments, I think, are inartful. I think that most Oklahomans would look at him and say, This guy is not, we don't want to put a lot of credibility in what he's saying. And frankly, the system worked, right? The bill that he was ultimately going after failed. I think that if you people can look at this website and make up their mind as to whether or not they want to listen to Al Gearhart. But the conviction itself last week, the blackmail conviction, I think is a dangerous precedent. If you're a citizen lobbyist or a lobbyist and you go to a lawmaker now and say, hey, I want you to vote for this, and if you don't, I'm going to have a hard time supporting you, or I'm going to support your opponent in the next election cycle, I think that, you know, that creates this question, well, is that blackmail? I suspect that there will be an appeal there. Whether you agree with Gearhart or not, I think that we've got to give the benefit of the doubt to political speech. The marketplace of ideas works. Let the people
sort it out. The First Amendment has to be
there. Yeah, let the First Amendment play itself out.
Neva, have you had a chance to check out this website yet?
I have. And, I mean, it's pretty clear. I mean, this is just a one more attempt at trying to take a pound of flesh off of Senator Cliff Brannon and, frankly, try to smear his campaign efforts as he's running for the Corporation Commission Republican nomination next month. So, you know, nothing really new. And unfortunately for most Oklahomans, I think most Americans, this is the kind of stuff that goes on in political campaigns that really disgust them. I mean, it's not about First Amendment. This is about gutter politics. And I think when you get into this give and take, people just kind of want to tune it out. And, you know, I mean, here's one example of someone who's given folks a lot of reason to do that, I think.
Yeah, tune it out. Don't criminalize it, though. Just tune it out.
Well, I mean, a jury of his peers, you know, heard evidence and made a decision. And, you know, and I think, frankly, they made a statement, but it wasn't a throw the book. I mean, he didn't do jail time. The fine was not anywhere near what it could have been, the $15,000. It was only $1,000, as I recall. So, you know, they made a definitive statement based upon the evidence presented, and that's part of the process. And, frankly, I applaud them for for making the system work.
The assistant district attorney there said that he hopes people think twice now before they make statements like this. And I think that in and of itself is evidence that charges like this create a chilling effect on political speech. And whether it's political speech that we find is gutter politics or not, the fact remains, you know, that political speech ought to be protected.
A wide latitude on political speech. I mean, we know it. We see it in every campaign cycle. We've all been directly or indirectly involved in watching it. And I think that's very different from clear threats. I mean, there is a line, and once you cross that line, there needs to be accountability for that. And I think that's what we're talking about in this instance.
Thank you very much. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.